This is the session on the Holden diet, food stewardship and the Holden diet. And my name is Sharon Gonzalez, and I'm one of the cooks here. I also cooked here all last summer and gave a few sessions on the diet then, too. So I'd like to begin by just maybe explaining to you where I'm kind of coming from with all this and what my experience has been. First of all, I'm not a nutritionist by degree or by schooling. I became a vegetarian in college and became interested in alternative diets somewhat in college. And it was sort of, you know, when vegetarianism was still kind of people experimenting and a lot of college students experimenting with it. And as I started to read things, I kind of got a broad picture of alternative eating and, you know, eating less meat and moving a little bit more into a simple diet. And then after college, I worked in Africa for about 4 years with both Peace Corps and then World Vision International. And with both of those agencies, I did nutrition education, I did famine relief in some of the famine areas during the drought in 85 and during the war in Chad in 85. And then community development and kind of looking at food and nutrition as a part of the third world economics and diet and the whole international dynamics. And then since coming back to this country, I've done large-scale cooking and got some experience then working with large-scale cooking in this country, mostly on the Peace March, first of all in 86, where I cooked for 9 months for the march that was walking across the country from LA to DC for global nuclear disarmament. I was a marcher too, but I cooked a lot. And then here up at Holden last summer and now this summer. And I kind of would like to stay with cooking and with nutrition in some capacities. So what I'd like to share today too is kind of the reason why I titled it Food Stewardship is that it's kind of a general picture of how we would look at diet and the whole idea of the consequences of our actions, the consequences of our diet, both for us as a nation, for our health, and for world standards. A couple really good books that I've gotten my information from and have been influenced by very heavily is, first of all, Laurel's Kitchen, which I read when I was in college. This is a really good book. She goes into really good, thorough explanations of eating more of a vegetarian diet, moving away from meat, why to do that, both economic, environmental, and health reasons, and this other book, Diet for a Small Planet, which was also very influential for me. And this, she also, Frances Moore LaPay, continues to be involved in working toward better food policy and a lot of issues related to diet and food use, especially on the political level. And this book is very good and very comprehensive in explaining vegetarian diets and alternative eating. So what I'd like to do today is and also leave some time for discussion at the end. If I talk a little bit fast, slow me down. It's my style. I just am a fast talker. I'd like to kind of talk about the four different aspects, first of all, of food stewardship, and then we can go into the Holden diet specifically. And what I'd like to concentrate on is the nutritional aspects of looking at our diet and moving away from a lot of red meats and a lot of meats. So the nutritional reasons to do that, the ethical reasons to do that, the environmental reasons to do that, and the economic. I think I said ethical second and economic last. So there's about four different ways that the approach to an alternative diet has been looked at throughout the years. And if you have any questions, you know, please feel free to raise your hand or some clarification. I'm going to just touch on each of them rather briefly, but hopefully give you at least enough information that it will kind of create a broader picture. There's a couple chairs up here too, if you'd like, over in the back here. Nutritional reasons, I guess, one of the main things that we start out with is that just about everywhere in the world, there is enough carbohydrate food for people to eat to get energy. Whether that be, you know, potatoes, you know, or as I saw in Africa, they eat a lot of millet and a lot of rice. In this country, we eat a lot of bread and a lot of other forms of carbohydrate food that give us energy. So as far as there being basically a lot of food available all throughout the world, there is a lot of carbohydrate food. But when we look at diet and food stewardship, we're looking very, very heavily at the question of proteins. Because proteins, of course, are the crucial foods that we all need for cell reproduction and growth. And it, no matter how much protein a person might, I mean, no matter how many carbohydrates a person might eat, if those carbohydrates do not have some proteins in them, then they are eating foods that will burn off as energy, but will not allow the reproductive and the growth processes to go on in the cells. So proteins are a real big thing. And first of all, they're the body's building blocks. They are necessary for bones, muscles, tissues, skin, and hair. And they are comprised of 20 different amino acids. As protein foods are broken down in the system, they are comprised of amino acids, 14 of which our body can synthesize on its own and can, from all the food that we ingest, can produce on our own. But there are 8 of which we need to get from other food substances. And when we don't get those other amino acids in the proteins, then that's when, you know, you see stunted growth in children, your hair falls out, you're weaker. I mean, your body is not continually reproducing new cells and growing and maintaining its health. So, the foods that of course are very high in all the amino acids and provide all those amino acids to us are fish and meat and usually most forms of animal products. Okay, so fish, meat, eggs, and in some cases milk, but it's milk I don't think has all of the amino acids that we need. I'm not sure about that. If any of you know that, please correct me. But definitely fish and meat and other animal products have all the amino acids. So when we eat those foods, we are getting all of the amino acids in proteins that our body needs. Okay? Now, if a person is not able to eat meat, for example, poor people in other parts of the world that can only consume very little meat, they need to get their proteins then from a combination of other foods. And these amino acids are found in other foods. However, other foods like the grains, rice and millet and corn and beans and legumes, nuts, all those foods will have the various amino acids, but not all of them at once like you get in meat, where all of them are present. So all you need to do is eat a steak and you'll get all of them at once. With the other foods, they are incomplete. So you'll have some amino acids found in corn, for example, and some other amino acids found in beans, for example. And when you eat those together, then you are getting, again, all the amino acids, especially the 8 other amino acids that our body does not produce. You will get those when you blend foods together. So sometimes you'll hear kind of, you know, among vegetarians, you'll hear the language of, you know, complementary proteins and, you know, working toward complete proteins and everything like that. And again, complementary proteins just means that you're eating a few different food sources. It can be as limited as 2, but it can also be made up of a combination of 3 or more. You're eating a variety of foods that together will complement each other in providing all of the amino acids that our body needs. Those would be complementary. Yes?
Sure. I think I've heard that there's 1 amino acid or something that's difficult if I'm on a vegetarian diet to get.
Yes, and I don't remember the name of that.
Vitamin.
Dorothy, do you know that?
B12.
Mm-hmm. So it's not the amino acids, right? That I think there are a couple amino acids that are a little bit harder to find. I mean, you have to continue to eat certain foods as a vegetarian that you'll eat more regularly to get those. And that is really interesting. I don't want to go into all of the explanation of amino acids though, because that's going to, you know, kind of derail us from the broader picture. But just at least to know this, that, all right, so complementary proteins are the proteins that are found in different foods that once eaten together or within a reasonable period of time, they will become digested together and all of the amino acids will be there. And then complete proteins is using the amount of the amino acids in each food in a way that will provide the correct amount of protein for the diet. An example would be that, you know, you have some amino acids that you'd find in wheat, and then you have other amino acids that you'll find in cheese and milk. And when put together, they complement each other. But if you don't eat them in the correct ratio, then you don't get the complete amount of protein that you need. Okay, so it gets a little bit complicated. As a vegetarian, you have to kind of slowly work into understanding what the ratios should be. Usually, it's 2 parts grain to 1 part bean or dairy. So you need 2 parts of rice to 1 part of beans. But beans and rice eaten together are a complete protein, as long as you eat them in the right proportion. Okay, and then your body uses those proteins efficiently and to the maximum amount that they can. So when we look then nutritionally at this whole idea of proteins, you find that with a vegetarian diet, we're eating what we call, we're eating lower on the food chain. And what that means is that this graph is taken from Diet for a Small Planet. What we mean is that when we look at the amount of grain, the poundage of grain or soy or cornmeal or oats, whatever kind of grain you're feeding the livestock to produce meat, this is the pounds of grain or soy to get to equal 1 pound of meat, poultry or eggs. So take for example the chicken, it needs to be fed 3 pounds of the grain and soy in order to produce 1 pound of meat. And usually 1 pound of meat can serve how many people? Maybe two or three people, approximately 1 pound of poultry. With turkey, you have to feed the turkey 4 pounds of grain or soy to get 1 pound of meat. With pork, it's 6 pounds of grain for 1 pound of meat. And with beef, you need to feed cattle up to 16 pounds of the grain in order to get just 1 pound of meat. And again, 1 pound of meat could serve maybe 3 or 4 people. Whereas 16 pounds of grain can serve, you know, well into 25 or 30 people. Again, the people then would have to complement this with some other form of food, either another dairy product or a legume. But that amount of grain or soy could actually feed that many more people. And in the third world, like that, what I experienced in Africa when I was a Peace Corps volunteer, is we ate predominantly grains. And I lived on predominantly millet and cornmeal. And then we only actually had meat maybe once or twice a week, because that's all the family could afford. And that was enough, but we needed to eat a diet where we were eating a lot more grain and soy. Well, actually, they didn't have soy over there, but grain and corn and millet. And we'd eat that in conjunction with, at times, beans or other vegetables that would give us the protein, very little meat. So when we talk about eating lower on the food chain, we're talking about moving down toward consuming more whole foods, more grain foods that feed our body directly, instead of going through the chain of, you know, the cow consuming the grain and then us consuming the cow. It's more like we just consume the grain directly. So, and that concept again, I mean, I could do a much better job explaining that, but there's also information that you can read on that I'd be happy to, you know, give you resources on that. And it's a real interesting, a whole interesting concept on that. So now if we move away from the whole idea of proteins, that's kind of the basis of looking at consuming less meat. Other reasons for that is that the higher we eat on the food chain and the higher up we go into poultry and pork and cattle and beef, we also many times increase the amount of pesticides and hormones and chemicals that are found in meat sources, because the meat, the animals are consuming grains and fertilizers and pesticides as they eat the grains. So we get concentrated forms of pesticides and fertilizers and hormones and other kinds of chemicals, which are actually, of course, not really good for our body, and they are found in concentrated forms in meats, because it's like, again, it's like 16 pounds of grain were consumed to get 1 pound of beef. So that's another reason why it's like it's even better for us to not be consuming all of those chemicals and fertilizers, and, you know, I mean indirectly the fertilizer production and the hormones and the different kinds of things that animals ingest. Another nutritional reason is that just basically eating less meat and eating less animal flesh products will actually provide us less cholesterol, which can help us to reduce some of the health problems that we get when we consume too much cholesterol. Many times also eating a whole foods diet, we eat less fats and less sugar, which also can again reduce some of the health problems that we have in this country, can produce problems of obesity and of tooth decay and some of the other problems that are very prevalent among Americans in Western society. And you know, one other kind of basic concept you can look at is that sometimes eating lower on the food chain like that and eating more grains are kind of like, they're cleaner foods. Our bodies digest those in a cleaner way. We usually utilize everything. There's less waste. There's less of the fatty kind of things that you'll find with meats that kind of attach in our arteries and attach into our different cells of our bodies that kind of are harder to digest and are harder to get rid of and process. Whereas if we eat it lower on the food chain, if we eat more whole foods, our body kind of processes those very clean, in a very clean way. We utilize and we burn up exactly what we need, and usually the waste of what we don't need goes out right through our intestines in kind of a cleaner way, I would just call it. So it's kind of a cleaner digestion to eat whole foods. So, of course, that's far inadequate for the actual nutritional reasons, further nutritional reasons, but those are just the main areas that I wanted to concentrate on for the nutritional reasons of looking at the kind of diet that we eat here at Holden and why we do that. So, you know, if you have questions, we can go on to that. I would like to move on, though, to the other reasons, too. Next, I would like to talk about the ethical reasons. And among a lot of studies and people in the last 10 years, a lot of the ethical reasons that have been brought up for eating vegetarian diet is the whole idea of the stewardship of the animals on the earth. Last night in Vespers, we read a little bit that short prayer from Chief Seattle, and how he encouraged the white population to really remember that the animals are a part of God's creation, that we need to be stewards of them too. And there's nothing wrong with consuming meat, but to the level that we consume it in this country, a lot of people have been very concerned about our relationship to animals and our care of the earth by consuming so much meat. Again, even when the Native Americans in this country ate meat, they might have killed a buffalo or a cattle every 3 or 4 days, or maybe only twice a week instead of meat 2 or 3 times a day. So just the amount that we consume of meat in this country has been questioned by a lot of people, just because it seems very excessive. And is that really the proper stewardship of us as being, the stewards of God's creation in relationship with animals and with nature? So a lot of ethical questions around vegetarian diet have been kind of born from and have come from the whole issue of our relationship to animals, and just how much is it right for us to be killing animals in such excess. Okay, the next category we can look at kind of is the environmental reasons. And a lot of the environmental reasons focus on, again, the use of land. Our stewardship of the land, and is that correct? Is how we're using the land really appropriate to the way that God has given us kind of the authority of that? And a lot of land is used to produce meat and for meat production, and yet actually we find that I'd like to read something from Francis Morlepay, that actually an acre of cereal can produce 5 times more protein than an acre of meat production. An acre of legumes, which would be beans, peas, and lentils, can actually produce 10 times more protein than an acre used for meat production. And an acre of leafy vegetables, so if you had an acre of spinach or broccoli or other vegetables, they could actually produce 15 times more ingestible protein than would an acre devoted to meat production. So, I don't exactly know how she did her studies and how the people that compiled this book did their studies, but that is something that has been looked at, that one acre devoted to other forms of protein production can produce many more times yield than an acre devoted to meat production.
Where do they take these figures from, or what part of the country or world?
Well, that's what I don't know. It just says, all she says is that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has, let's see, she says the U.S. Department of Agriculture has pointed out that grain makes up only 25% of feed units that cattle consume. So, and she uses the U.S. Department of Agriculture a lot throughout this. So I assume that a lot of it has been done through studies that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has been involved in.
I guess after you do something like that, then you take a look at all the exceptions in Montana, where we have a lot of arid land that can't be used for anything. Mm-hmm. It takes about 32 acres in our part of the country to support one cow for 6 months, but there's no other use for that land.
Uh-huh.
So it's a very good use of
land. Okay, right. Okay, sure. And that's fine. I mean, that is good stewardship of the land. I mean, that is using the land and allowing it to produce what it can. But there's a lot of other parts of the country where we actually do a lot of grazing for beef production, when really that land could be used more for other forms of protein production that could either be used in this country or shipped abroad somehow and shared with other parts of the world where land is more inferior, and where there's not good land either for producing food. So I'm definitely don't want to, you know, insinuate that I'm trying to be against meat eating or meat production or anything. I just am a part of looking at it in kind of the way of both stewardship and for health and environmental and economic reasons. And all these things can be debatable and can be discussed for hours at length. I just wanted to give a brief overview of why, even at Holden here, we have chosen this kind of diet and some of the reasons behind our diet here and why we continue to serve food that has less meat in it and that is more kind of like whole foods and some foods that us in typical American society are not really used to eating all the time. And then another environmental reason is the whole idea of the waste that is involved in eating higher on the food chain. As I was just reading just very briefly there, actually only maybe 25% or less of the amount of grain that a cattle eats can actually then be converted into the amount of protein that a human would be able to consume. Other of it goes for waste, and it is thrown away in other forms, and it is wasted, or it is used for other forms of feeding other animals or something, but it's not being used directly for protein consumption that humans could ingest. I mean, protein that humans could consume. So there's a lot of waste that goes on as you eat higher up on the food chain. And
where do fish come in this?
Well, fish. There is very little waste with fish. Fish are actually a very good, a good source of protein and a very clean, digesting source of protein. Fish. There's not as much debate about fish. The ethical questions about fish is just how much are we stripping our oceans again in a way that is kind of too fast for what nature could produce. You know, I mean the whole ethical questions of some species being going, you know, having at times gone close to being extinct or things like that. It would just be amounts that we are worried about with fish. So fish is a very good source of protein, and a lot of people in this country that have been moving away from red meat because of the health consequences of red meat, with increased cases of heart disease and cholesterol, increasing the cholesterol count and everything. A lot of people then have substituted the meat consumption with fish consumption, and that is a much better and a much cleaner source of protein. And environmentally, the questions there again would just have to do with just how much do we deplete the natural resources of the fish life according to what we really need. You know, again, because we don't really need to consume fish every day. We can consume other sources of protein and still maintain our good health. So again, I mean, the whole question of stewardship, it's like, well, even that can be be relatively defined. You know, some people will define stewardship in one way, of stewardship of the resources and of the food, and other people will define it in other ways. So I'm certainly not, you know, trying to advocate just one way of looking at it. But it is a question, the whole idea of food stewardship is a question of us looking at the consequences of our diet on a variety of different levels. And how do we understand about those? How do we feel about those consequences? The last category after environmental reasons would be the economic and international reasons that we would look at food and try to understand our own food stewardship and how it relates to the international level. Three kind of ideas around that would be, first of all, with our diet in this country, we have a lot of products that are imported to us that actually are kind of taking from third world countries their main sources of protein. Really good examples would be the cashews that here at Holden we get imported from India. Really, in India, cashews could be a main source of protein that the women might use in their sauces to work with the rice. And we consume those in a way that is much more of kind of a luxury food, you might say. I mean, we don't really need to eat cashews, but we enjoy the taste, we like them, we import them as a nation because we have the money to, but actually that could be one of their main sources of protein. And I directly saw that in Africa, because in the village that I lived in, there were cashew trees, but we never ingested cashews. It's like they were harvested, they were used as a cash crop to export to Europe or America, and I never ate cashews in Africa, and yet that's the land that they come from. And that could have been a source of protein. A lot of the protein that I ate with the family that I lived in came from peanuts, which they did grow themselves, and it's a very big crop in Mali, West Africa. and we ate peanuts in our sauces. They made a lot of peanut sauces, and then that combined with the rice was a complete protein. But also the cashews could have been used for another source of protein to alter the diet a little bit and give a little bit of a different taste. But actually, I never saw cashews at all in the country. And the whole process of there's a certain kind of a poison, so cashews have to be refined in a certain way, or there's something that has to be done chemically in order for them to be ingested. And maybe, you know, a long time ago, people in Africa knew how to do that, but I certainly never ate cashews in Africa, and yet they grew on the trees, you know, in the nearby village. So there's a lot of examples of that where we, as first world nations, both America and Europe, can take some of these products from third world nations and have them as a part of our diet, but they're not really an essential part of our diet, where in those countries they might be really an essential part of their diet.
But selling them to us is a very essential part of their economy.
Well, yes, but then, you know,
we just say, we're going to do them a favor and not eat cashew nuts so they can have them. We could easily destroy their economy.
Well, that's true. But a lot of times what the money goes for actually in those countries is not for better food. I mean, food is the basis of life nonetheless. And even if we are then giving them money which helps their government to get stronger, or a lot of times their government can use that money for military strength and a lot of other very questionable reasons as far as the basics of human needs, then in essence we are still kind of depleting some of their basic food sources in their country, which contributes to famines and other forms of malnutrition. And then that kind of goes into the whole idea of even cash crops. Now, although peanuts and cashews and things can also be considered cash crops, they are not even maybe as much of a cash crop as you'd say cotton or coffee or cocoa. And cotton and coffee and cocoa have been three main cash crops that first world countries have gone into third world countries. The climate is ripe, the land is ripe, the people are ready to farm those in order to make money. So we then begin to create crops where we will actually receive the crop when it is harvested. We will pay them money for it, but it is using their land to produce, and then they have less land to produce food. And that again was a very prime example. I could even see in the village that I lived in, my family and the other farmers in the village actually grew cotton because the Europeans, the French, would come in and buy it so they could get money for the cotton. But for every bit of cotton that was being grown, that much less millet was being grown. And the second year that I was a volunteer there, there actually was kind of a difficulty with the rains, and it was a mild drought, and they had that much less millet than to kind of get through that summer while waiting for the rains that maybe they could have had if they were able to harvest more the year before, and if they had actually used all of their land to produce the food that they could have used then in a pinch when the surplus was low. But instead they used a lot of that land for cotton. And I saw the whole exchange. I saw the people come in and weigh all these major tons of cotton, and a lot of the farmers get paid for it. And yet what did my family and the other families in the village do with the money is they bought tobacco, and they bought, you know, radios because they like radios, and they bought other luxuries, more westernized luxuries that really they didn't need and weren't going to go for their diet, but nonetheless they wanted. So there's just a lot of implications there, and of course I'm not trying to say that we have any effect on the way Africans spend their money. We don't. But I just mean that creating a whole system of cash crops, in fact, it does reduce the amount of land that third world countries have to grow their own food that they need to meet their levels of nutritional needs. And instead they grow crops that we will pay them for and that are part of our diet, but that actually nutritionally don't do anything for us. So it's the whole question again of land stewardship and of the whole international dynamic of land stewardship, and that's been a very heavily researched and very hot issue over the past 10 or 15 years with a lot of people that have been studying the whole diet in America and the questioning of whether or not our food stewardship is appropriate for other countries or at times exploitative. And then one other thing, too, that can kind of go with either both the economic reasons or the environmental reasons would be even how the level of sophistication that our food system in this country has attained is very questionable. All the packaging of foods that we do and all the resources that are used to box cereals and to package all the foods that we eat in all different forms. You know, I don't exactly know what the percentage is, but I know that of a box of cereal that you buy, there's a fairly large percentage that you're paying for just for the packaging. And that's pretty clear knowledge on everything. You pay for packaging. And our food system, too, has gotten to a level that it is so sophisticated that we use a lot of other resources to produce food, to package it, to ship it throughout all parts of the country, in a way that is really using a lot of the Earth's resources. And possibly we could be using those resources in a different way, or we could be using less of those resources and trying to provide resources to other countries that really need it, that have land that's far more inferior, or that just are limited in their own abilities to produce. So, I mean, again, that gets kind of sticky, because that gets into all kinds of issues of politics and everything. And I don't mean to be trying to, make us feel like we need to be making all these changes. But there is a lot of things that need to be questioned about our level of the way we eat in this country and the whole food system that we continue to perpetuate in this country. So, first of all, before I go into the Holden diet, then, is there any questions on that, or and even, please, points of disagreement? I've done this lecture a couple times last summer too, and there was definitely some people that very much disagreed with some of the points or some of the ethical questions, and they didn't feel that we should be cutting out meat or things. So if you disagree, I mean, it's a good discussion topic.
My only difficulty with this is I know a lot of vegetarians, and I don't know any of them that are healthy. I try to watch my diet, but I love beef and I love pork and I love meat and everything, and I'm never sick and I'm always healthy. And I have to see a healthy vegetarian. So I really question.
Well, what is unhealthy about them? Do you find them getting sick?
Well, they're sick all the time. They've got colds. They've got flu. They're just never well.
Right. Okay.
They're not in the hospital, but they just never seem to be functioning in good health. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the difficulties I have with it. I'm not convinced that it's a healthy way to to live.
Okay, well, that's a good point. A lot of it depends on the person's own responsibility then in finding how to get a good healthy diet from that. A lot of vegetarians just cut out meat, but they don't take the time to cook beans and cook other grains that you need to take time to cook. It's just like when you put a roast in the oven, it takes 3 hours to cook, and that's a little bit easier because then all you have to do is just put it in the oven. But with a vegetarian diet, you have to take the time to cook beans for 2 hours then and cook other other grains that will take a long time. So some people don't really take the time to use the other foods and the whole kind of hassle sometimes that it takes to produce to have a healthy vegetarian diet, and they'll kind of cut corners and cut meat out of their diet but not necessarily find other adequate ways to
balance. Yeah, I think
that.
I've seen a lot of people just say, well, I'm going to become a vegetarian, and they just say, I'm not going to eat red meat anymore.
Definitely. And that's not the way to go about it.
Run down and they don't get any iron.
Right. Because the other examples are at Holden here. I mean, there's staff people. Myself, I've been here for a year, and there's other staff people that have been here for 2 years, and they're eating solely on this diet. And I mean, I haven't had a cold for a couple of years. And a lot of people that eat here are in good health. And some lose weight a little bit when they start eating consistently on the diet, and they find they have more energy, and they just kind of can. There's a lot of positive consequences. Mm-hmm. Too, that people here have been eating for months and months at a time that are still here and they're very healthy. Yes?
What about the chemicals that are used on vegetables and fruit and that type of thing?
Yeah, well, that's unless you get your fruit and vegetables from an organic farmer. And there's some vegetarian food co-ops and food stores in this country that do sell organic, organically grown vegetables, and that's great. You usually have to pay higher for it. Because they're not. That's not the what the market is producing. The market has found ways to produce a lot of foods that can be consumed, and most all of them will have pesticides on them. So it's very hard to find organically grown food. But you can either grow it yourself or try to purchase it from organic farms. That's really a good way. In most all the grocery stores that we all buy from, including us here at Holden, I think we buy very few products from any organic places. We buy it mostly too from commercial places. And the only way is if a person is really concerned about that. They can soak any of their fresh vegetables that they're going to eat that are not going to be cooked in a mild chlorine solution or Clorox solution, and that I've been told. I haven't actually tried it myself. I did that in Africa when I had to watch for other kind of infectious things on the vegetables. But in this country, I've heard that also in a mild, very mild chlorine solution, a little bit of Clorox, a little bit of bleach, just soak in a very, very mild solution of bleach, that actually somehow helps to break down some of the fertilizers and pesticides and help them leave the vegetables and the leaves.
But does the cooking then do that?
That I'm not sure. I don't know, because I know.
You said if you
right.
if you're going to eat it raw.
Right. Well, that's what I was told. That if you eat it raw, there might be something that has to do with cooking, but I don't know
so
exactly what it is.
So rinsing things off doesn't do a thing.
Rinsing things off doesn't do a thing. Dorothy, do you have any information on that, or would you know about pesticides or things?
Well, the pesticides that are used on vegetables are all approved by the EPA, and I feel are edible, and I really don't feel that a Clorox, the bleach, the weak bleach water is to destroy the microorganisms there. I have never heard anything about that as a pesticide.
Yeah, well, I only heard that from
and
one source.
They have to be washed before they can be sold. I mean, they can't. The pesticide level on the fruit itself cannot be above a FDA requirement. Cannot be above a certain level.
I
can't even be sold. So
I don't
have to wash apple.
I'm skeptical about the FDA requirements. I remember Co-op. Yeah.
Yes.
And they said that I remember in our newsletter they said that the amount of pesticides that the EPA or FDA allowed in avocados is such that I can eat one avocado a year without getting to
really?
That level.
Yeah.
So I buy organic avocados.
Right.
And I try to buy as much organic.
But the problem is when you say there is no standard for organic, quote, organic, either you don't know what the farm, any farmer can tell you this is grown organic.
There is in
Anyone
California.
That wants to.
There is in California.
There isn't.
I know, but at least by buying organic, I tend to minimize the amount of pesticides I'm getting. And it's a thing, it's worth the extra money to do.
Right, exactly. Whether it's with the extra money, some people are very concerned about cancer and other sicknesses that have been also, they can't directly prove that cancer is caused by pesticides, but there's been a lot of research that's tried to look into that, and a lot of people do believe that all the chemicals that we ingest in our food is also contributes to cancer in our society being so high, and other forms of sickness that you don't necessarily see in other parts of the world as readily. And we all ingest the food, we all ingest the water, and both are very polluted. The land has been very polluted, and the water has been very polluted in our nation, and both are things that we can't avoid ingesting. The whole idea of consequences, it has been studied by a lot of different people in a lot of different ways.
I can also minimize pesticides by not buying Mexican produce.
Really?
Because we export DDT and a lot of other chemicals to third world countries, and they spray like crazy there. Mm-hmm. And then it comes in this country and they test a lot of it. And some at the border to catch.
It has to be tested, or it couldn't be sold here. It has to be tested.
No. They've got only so much staff that can test all the pesticides that comes across the border. And a lot of it gets through. And
how do you know if it's Mexican?
Because my co-op, they'll say the origin. And in the winter, I know that tomatoes, most red tomatoes, are Mexican.
Okay, I didn't know that either. Yeah, and a lot of this stuff is still debatable. It's new to me. As I learn new things, I try to, check out the source and just like the whole thing about a few years ago when salt was the big thing, you don't need any salt in your diet and everything, and other people, it's also proven that salt is a food. We do need a certain amount of salt, so cutting out all salt is not healthy either. So there's on all kinds of nutritional questions, there's a lot of debate, and each of our bodies are very individual. Some people need meat, they really do. Their own body production and what they crave for their protein source tends to be more often meat. And you just, no matter how much they might try to stay on a vegetarian diet for years, they still find that there's something about when they eat meat that gives them a certain other feeling of energy and health and well-being. So each of our bodies are very different, and we have to try to get a little bit more in tune with that and become a little bit more harmonized with what our body needs, and then just adjust our diet accordingly, according to that. Marilyn, do you have a question?
I was wondering about the calories.
Uh-huh.
And if vegetarians need to eat more often than 3 times a day.
Well,
I find myself after 2 hours getting hungry.
Yeah.
And so you go for a candy bar. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, is it something that you need to eat more often?
No,
would
not.
Would that take care of it? What is the caloric intake here?
Well, it's no different. I mean, the caloric intake would still be, close to 3,000 calories for a man. And I don't know, close to 2,500 for a woman, something like that.
So how much do you need to get that?
Well, it just depends on what you're eating.
You know,
well, it depends on what you're eating.
I'm just kind of curious because I just find I get real hungry after
Usually,
and I'm not the only one. I talk to other people, and if they don't get some first dinner,
Well, in some ways, first of all, you know, the body has to get kind of adjusted to that kind of a diet. And once you start ingesting grains on a regular basis, you'll know your amount that you can you know, go with. A lot of times, you will eat a lot more. I mean, I know from my experience in Africa when I didn't have milk readily available. There was no cheese, no eggs, or anything readily available. And I was literally on a much more of a grain diet and just vegetables or beans. I could eat a lot more rice. I could eat like a huge plate of rice, and I neither gained weight nor did I then get hungry later on. I mean, but I needed a lot of rice to eat with a lot of sauce on it. I mean, a very large plate, much larger than I would eat in this country. And in this country, because I can eat cheese on it, and I can have eggs, and I can have milk, and I can have other foods that do kind of, I don't know, it just changes the need for that many grains. But if you're living on just grains, you have to eat a lot more, yeah, definitely.
It seems like with the fat, it's the low fat.
Right, it's the fat.
Because fat does give satiety.
It makes you feel
fuller
longer.
And it takes longer to digest, and therefore...
Because I can eat a small piece of meat, and it'll last me a long time.
It's fat.
But here, it seems like I just get
worse. Calories are the same. You can get calories from fat or from carbohydrates, but it's the satiety.
So we meet the fat requirements here, then, is what you're saying.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you need very little fat for a week.
It's just interesting to try to figure out what it is here that I'm having trouble with.
Right. I know. Well, Marilyn, a lot of people, I mean, some people will say, boy, I felt great this week, and I'm so satisfied after the meals. I don't want a snack. I don't want candy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just really very individual. I mean, it depends on a lot of factors.
Those, but maybe.
Right. Yeah. Right. That's all right. I mean, and no, that's okay. And the thing is, maybe, right, that's all right. I appreciate that. And I also appreciate that maybe the people with the positive comments are the ones that come up to the kitchen and probably say, oh, they really like the food and and then the people maybe that haven't found it to be a positive experience won't voice that, and yet I would really like to hear that too, you know. I mean, just last week, you know, Kent, the business manager here, came up, and even Dane said several people are complaining about too much cheese in the diet. I'm doing menus right now, so they says, can you please like not put so much cheese in the diet, you know, the next few weeks in the menu? And I was like, I can't believe it. It's not like we have cheese in every meal, and we need some cheese and dairy in our meals to complement a lot of the grains that we
My doctor doesn't bread. Want me to eat any cheese because I have high cholesterol count.
Well, I know, but then for certain cases like that, it's like, you know, how much did then I cut out all the cheese for the whole community, when really for other people that are used to eating a lot of meat, cheese in once a day in every meal is not going to be detrimental to them. So it's like, it's really like a juggling act, because sometimes we'll get comments real strong or like, you know, hardly any eggs. And the last cook that was doing menus, it's like he put eggs on the menu once a week, and I'm like, Brian, we need other forms of protein, especially in the summer. People come here that have been eating a lot more meat, and we've got to be able to still give their bodies protein. You can't just go off protein so drastically. So that I've tried to be putting, you know, eggs twice a week for breakfast, and then in some other meal, like a quiche meal or something else that has a batter to it that has eggs in it, because, I mean, we need those forms of direct, you know, more solid proteins for people that are not used to always eating complementary proteins, where you have a lot of beans and grains, and who will eat a lot less of that because they're not...
Havoc with the intestinal tract.
Yeah, that's true too, exactly, right? A lot, definitely a lot of flatulation, you know, because you're not used to eating that kind of diet. So it's just, it's been kind of, at times it's hard to weigh all the different needs of community members, but there's...
Mm-hmm. My other question was I know that a lot of vegetarian diets are low in iron, and unless you know what to eat when you go to a meal, you are not getting enough iron. And I know I talked with you about this, and I went to the books, and things like bran flakes and stuff are very high, but if all you're eating is bread and milk, you're not getting much iron.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to up my iron, and that has helped
to
try to do that. But if you don't know what to look for, I think in this altitude, if people are used to lower altitude, that also might be a reason if you don't have much energy.
Right, okay.
If you don't know what to eat in a vegetarian diet.
I know, and I don't really, you know, I too, I've been concerned about that, like when we talked about it, and yet I know, like I said, I've been here for the past year, and you know, I feel like I when I check my, you know, my eyes for, you know, for low, real pale pink or anything. I mean, a lot of people here don't seem to have problems with anemia or anything. Staff people that have been here for a year or more, and that certainly over the long term would affect us, and they don't seem to. So I think that I need to really study the diet more to find out where we're getting
it. Blood samples.
Yeah, it would be. That's true. It would be. I know.
So the hemoglobin. It's just something that I know I had to really be aware of.
Okay. Yes.
I think another aspect is that many people coming here become much more active. with the hiking.
Yeah, it's true.
And so their caloric needs rice. Become different than a more sedentary occupation or lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So that the lifestyle pattern may be markedly different for 10 days or 1 week or whatever the length of stay is.
That's true.
So all moderation in everything is really critical.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at our priorities and our values need to be tempered with a lot of moderation.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yes, did you have a question up here, ma'am? Did somebody have a question?
A couple. One of them is that I don't like too cheesy casseroles, and I think it tends to be a little too cheesy
here.
I like to see sliced cheese put on the table, so I could choose to eat it or not.
Okay.
And then another thing is, I don't use underarm deodorants because there's aluminum in it, or I don't like to use aluminum baking powder. I like to buy non-aluminum baking powder when I use baking powder. And this is stuff I read from my food co-op, and I've thrown away all my aluminum pots.
Right.
Because aluminum has been implicated with Alzheimer's disease.
Definitely, yes.
And now here in institutional cooking, there's monstrous aluminum pots in the kitchen.
I know, John, and that bothers me, and it definitely bothered the cooks last year, too. Deb and I were always worried about that and bothered by it. And a lot of it is financial. When we looked into getting rid of our aluminum pots and replacing them with stainless steel is so expensive that the budget just said, I'm sorry, but we can't do that. And for people that come here for a week, it's not going to hurt their health to have a little bit more aluminum. And yet for those of us that do stay for a year, it's like whenever I can use a stainless steel pots, I'll use them over the aluminum. But a lot of times, in getting the massive quantities of soups and casseroles and things, we do have to use the aluminum pots, and that is a concern, because I know that anything that's cooked in aluminum will, to some degree, I don't know what degree, but it will absorb some of that.
What about Teflon? Is that true too?
That I don't know. Do you know anything about Teflon?
I
don't know about
that. The old Teflon pots that kept scratching and all that disappearing into what we were eating.
Right.
I don't like this.
Yeah, I'm not sure about Teflon either, but I know that whenever you can, go with either iron pots or iron skillets. Right, iron skillets are great for even giving iron. Right, even giving putting iron into the diet. Iron skillets are really good for cooking with iron, or stainless steel. Right, and that is actually better in the long run. So that kind of stuff has concerned us too, but there's not really much we can do about it because of the financial situation.
Now, the only thing I was going to say is I have found the opposite as far as the week goes. As the week goes by, I find less desire for potato chips or crackers or even ice cream. It's fun at first to go to the ice cream, and by last night, I really didn't even want any.
Right. Uh-huh.
And the meal last night, I thought, isn't this wonderful? And I was so stuffed at the end of it that I really didn't feel as well after that as I have after the other meal.
Really? Uh-huh.
I didn't see people going back for seconds last night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really?
It was fun to eat it, but my body, I guess, was beginning to get used to the other.
Yeah, it will.
Very heavy for
me. Uh-huh. Yeah, and that'll vary for each person's needs, but...
Mm-hmm. The thing on these are the fresh vegetables. I mean, it seems like we get so much grain.
I know.
But where are the fresh vegetables?
I know.
Mm-hmm. And I think if you could just have carrot sticks and celery sticks out, the majority of the time that people would just nibble on those or have them if they want them.
Right.
It's something.
I know. Well, that's true. And we put the carrot and celery sticks out on the relish trays on Friday nights, and usually we'll have fresh vegetables during the week on the Wednesday salad bar, like we had salad bar this Wednesday. And other times when we have the bars like that, where people go through the line, there's always like fresh tomatoes and sometimes fresh broccoli and fresh mushrooms and things like that. But we do find that, again, financially, it would, to provide that much for regularly for every other meal, we can just find that people will actually eat vegetables more when it's cooked in some kind of a dish. So then we use just a lot more vegetables cooked in casseroles. I mean, we go through a lot of fresh produce, but we don't serve it fresh. We serve it in cooked form. But we use actually very little canned or very little frozen vegetables. And so it's also just a matter of, how do you really provide like fresh broccoli to people in a way that they're going to like it? I mean, sometimes when we don't even steam it that much so that it's not real soft, people complain that it was like too chewy, And how come the broccoli was so hard? It was, they didn't get the broccoli in time and now it's undercooked. So it's like even that whole concept is a concept of just what people are used to. So we have just found that actually fresh carrot sticks and celery sticks, I agree with though, and maybe I'll even talk to the other cooks about that, of providing that a little bit more often or putting that out with a casserole lunch instead of some of the other salads that we put out, or some of the canned fruit that we put out fresh fresh vegetables. So that's a good idea. I appreciate that. But then too, just what we have found on the larger scale is that we use a lot of, you know, fresh produce, but we end up cooking it and putting it into dishes more in cooked form.
The other thing I objected to is that one day we had soup with a cabbage in it, which is very gaseous. And then we had peas with raw peanuts. And the raw peanuts, again, I mean, it's kind of like, uh-oh, watch out. You know?
Okay.
It just really plays havoc on your digestive system.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'll try to remember to be more conscious of this. I guess my body's gotten so used to it that I don't have any problem with that now at all.
I've had
really
a problem
don't.
All week with that. Okay. That just goes with all the time.
Is that common for a lot of people? Can you just be honest?
Thank you. I'm serious. I can't believe how much that, since my body's used to it, I have. Okay. Well, I know the day that we had the peas and peanuts with the cabbage soup and the peas in the soup or something, I mean the beans in the soup, I said to myself, boy, this is a terrible combination. But the cooks that day had changed the menu for some other reason. There was something, the apples didn't come in or something. We had a Waldorf salad on for that meal, and either the apples weren't in or there was no cottage cheese, so they just quickly, there had been frozen peas pulled, they just quickly put together a pea peanut salad. And usually we put a pea peanut salad on a day where there's not any beans or cabbage or potatoes or other things. I know. So I'll even be more aware of that though too, right? Because I do forget that at times people that do come in for the week, they have a lot more gas and flatulence because of not being used to the diet.
Martin Bolden.
Well, you notice that when they hike, they're 10 feet apart.
If you don't mind, I'd like to just take two more questions, because then I want to explain a few more things about the whole diet before we run out of time.
I want to hear about the breads.
Right, I will. Yes, you have a question?
I'm just amazed that there's so much talk about the nutrition here, and there's so much junk food available.
I know.
If people were not able to buy that, they would appreciate the meal so much.
Well, I know, but that's debatable, because some people really tell us though that they are glad that we have snack bar and other things, because they're used to ingesting more desserts. They're used to having dessert more often, which we never have. We only have dessert on. We have some kind of dessert on the Friday night.
Dessert.
Well,
some people can't.
Right. It's almost like those things are optional. If people want to take advantage of them, they do.
We're people of choice.
Yeah, we are. Exactly.
Why not let
exactly.
people make the choice?
Right, exactly.
You know, that's where I feel that how much do you control people's
right.
lives? And to take
right.
all of that away.
Right.
And
we've talked about that
here. Make their own choices. If you don't want, you know, if somebody doesn't want ice cream or hot fudge or candy, then don't buy it.
Right. Yeah, we've discussed that here. I mean, we've even discussed about why on Thursday night Hunger Awareness Night is a snack bar open. Oh, we've had major community discussions on that for like a half hour, an hour at a time, because the whole issue of, well, if it's hunger awareness and the whole thing is to make us as Americans be more in solidarity with people that are hungry in other parts of the world, why can they go to the snack bar and get a large sundae then? And then other people will say, yes, but the exact issue of choices though. We are people of choice, and if people, you know, eat that meal because we impose it on them on Thursday night but then want something else, they have the right to that. So
but
we've had major community
this week it kind of worked out. You ran out of ice cream and you offered apples, and I don't think it bothered anybody.
Right, but even the running out of ice cream, that was by chance. Usually they order enough that there is enough from Friday to Friday. So it's something that the choice is always there.
Well, I think there's going to be raisins and apples and fresh fruit.
Yeah. Well, actually, right, it's just been this summer now that we sell fresh fruit in the bookstore. I don't know if any of you have seen that, but we do sell the pears and apples and oranges. Whatever fruit we have available will now sell in the bookstore, too, because of people wanting to request other, the healthier snack foods and not just always the candy.
Yeah, there's not much of a choice in terms, if you buy snacks, most of the snacks are junk.
Right. Except in the bookstore, right?
Not
we
a lot
do
of choices
food.
Of snacks.
No.
They used to have granola bars in the
refrigeration.
Yeah, they did. I don't remember that. Yes.
What about coffee? The effects of coffee. You know, I've heard that decaffeinated coffee, the process is using formaldehyde to take out the caffeine.
Right. Yeah.
So,
and now I think the coffee we use here is Nicaraguan coffee that's processed in Holland. And I'm pretty sure that it's processed with the water drip process, which is not using formaldehyde.
So if
you buy Nicaraguan coffee, we also have that in the bookstore. If you buy Nicaraguan coffee at either a co-op or a food, or if you buy any process that says water processed decaffeinated, then it's okay. And I don't
does
exactly
it, does it say that on most labels?
If it does that, it'll say it. But a lot of them, when they don't say it, it's the formaldehyde process.
Okay.
Yeah, they don't
so
say
what
it.
What you're saying is if it's processed
exactly
that way, it will.
Right.
Otherwise it's
definitely be aware, right? Because over a period of years, that kind of consumption of just decaf can be really toxic for the body in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
So if it says water processed, I don't exactly know what the process is that they do with water, but if it says water processed, then it's not used with the formaldehyde.
Okay, and an herbal tea doesn't have caffeine?
No, herbal tea has no caffeine
okay.
in it. And usually a lot of herbal teas can actually be medicinal. You know, chamomile and some of the other teas are actually medicinal,
mm-hmm.
so they can actually have positive effects on the body.
Such as?
Chamomile, I know for sure. Let's see, wait. Some of the various roots, marshmallow root tea, it's pretty hard to ingest it unless you put some sugar in it. But that is, sassafras tea is good for you. Jasmine, although that has some caffeine in it, but jasmine can have some medicinal qualities too. I don't know exactly what those are, but there's several of them that do. Rose hips are good. Rose hips is good. Rose hips tea.
Vitamin C, right.
Yeah, I know this is your presentation. I'd really like to hear about the Holden.
Right. I know, that's what I was just going to go into right now. Okay, so the Holden aspect of it is, in addition to us considering all these questions of food stewardship, and that's why we try to have this diet and introduce people to it and perpetuate it over the years, in addition to that, a lot of things that we find in the kitchen is just even to be more creative with the foods that we have available. As you've seen, you know, our Friday meal is the week in review for lunch, because we really try to avoid wasting food on any level that we can. So the Friday meal, that is the leftovers meal, is literally just all the leftovers we've had from the week put into some kind of combination that's going to be appealing. Sometimes the tastes get a little bit bizarre. Usually we try to combine them in a way that's going to be appealing. We add some cheese to it, and we actually hope that people won't mind eating leftover food. But it's stored in the proper conditions. It's kept at the proper temperature so that bacteria will not, you know, form, or a minimal bacteria will form. So we really try to take care of the food so that even though it's leftovers, it's being served correctly and actually, you know, sanitation codes are being met for it being edible food. And then we use leftovers in other ways. A lot of the hot cereals that we have during the week, that's what we use in bread. We use a lot of leftover oatmeal. We use a lot of leftover farina or the triticale. And triticale, by the way, too, is a hot cereal that's very high in iron. I just discovered that when Marilyn and I were working on her diet. And so triticale is a form of oats. But it's a form that has, I don't exactly know what part of it is or if it has other things added to it or a different combination of grains. But triticale is a cereal. 4 or 6 grain cereal is very good in iron. A lot of times we use even those cereals raw, like in our bread dough, as the bread is mixing up in the Hobart machine. We'll just go ahead and throw a couple, maybe a gallon or so of the raw cereal into that. Really, you know, we have these big gallon containers. We also use a lot of soy flour in meals that you can't even tell. You can't even see that. But it's very good for protein and for other vitamins and minerals and some iron. So we use a lot of soy flour in our granola bars. We use soy flour in bread. We use soy flour in some things that we can get away with, like if it's a kind of a health cake, a health food cake, or some kind of a date bar or something that we're using. We'll use soy flour in that. Soybeans we use in the diet, but actually pretty rarely. We only use soybeans maybe twice a month. At times I'll make soy milk and make that available to people, but it's kind of, the taste is different than regular milk, so not very many people are used to that. We also use a lot of nuts in foods that sometimes are visible and sometimes are not. A lot of times in the bread you'll see seeds. The little yellow seeds are raw millet, and we just go ahead and throw raw millet into the bread dough, and those are the little yellow ones. Or you'd see maybe the sunflower seeds, kind of the grayer seeds in bread as the sunflower seeds. So we try to use a variety of seeds in breads and in casseroles. We use seeds to top things with. We make seeds available for salads and salad bars, or we will sprinkle salads when we put them on the table with seeds. So we try to use a lot of nuts and seeds in the diet too. And then we try to balance the amounts of cheese that we're producing. We try to balance the amounts of beans that we're producing. Eggs, we usually serve, like I said, an egg dish that is obviously eggs twice a week, and the same thing with beans, a dish that obviously has beans in it twice a week. And then other dishes might have just a little bit of lentils in it or just a little bit of some other kind of bean in it, but the main dish is not beans. And we'll try to do that maybe once or twice a week. And then the cheese quantity too, not to overdose on cheese, but we like to definitely use cheese as a main protein in the diet.
What about your soups?
Pardon me?
Your soups.
Right. The soups we use a vegetable broth, which we make from all of our leftover vegetable trimmings. Well, I shouldn't say all, but most. Most of our vegetable trimmings we'll use. For example, spinach stems, when we wash the spinach for salad and for fresh spinach things, we'll use the spinach stems in we'll just label that stock. We'll use celery leaves, the tops of the celery, into stock. We'll use carrot tops when we cut them off, and the little bit of the carrot that you'll cut off with the top, we'll use that for stock. We'll use broccoli, the whole big bulk stock of the broccoli. We'll use that for stock. We'll just put all of these in stock buckets, and then once we have about four or five stock buckets in the refrigerator, then we'll boil all that. And then the water that is extracted from all that boiling, we'll boil it for about 20 minutes. We'll then strain off the vegetables. Those go into compost in a real decomposed form, sort of. They go into compost, and we'll use that fresh water as vegetable broth. And we'll use that in soups. We'll use that in casseroles sometimes. We'll use that in chili and other dishes that we'll make that we need a liquid for. We also save our potato water. When we make mashed potatoes and we pour off the water, we'll use that in bread or in soups also. So we always start our soups with kind of a sautéed base of onions and celery, and then we'll add our vegetable broth to it and any other water. If we don't have enough vegetable broth, we'll add the water to that, and then we go ahead and add our fresh vegetables. Usually all of our soups are made with fresh vegetables. And
soups are wonderful, I think, here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they vary quite a bit. I mean, each cook has, we each add our own little, creative flavor to whatever we're doing, but soups do become a main part of our diet, and when they're eaten with the bread, usually too, if there's some beans in the soup or if there's some fresh vegetables, and then the bread, and if there's some cheese made available, or if the person drinks milk, you actually can get a complete protein in that kind of a meal here. Yes?
If I were doing that at home, how long could I keep
vegetable water?
Or keep the pot. I suppose I could freeze that, couldn't I?
Yeah, you could freeze stock. Uh-huh. You can also, if you just take let's see, even for example, maybe an empty milk carton and just keep filling that up with any of your vegetable trimmings. I mean, we sometimes keep the stock just and keep adding to it for maybe 4 or 5 days in a row. I mean, it can go even up to a week. Just the only thing is when you open it up, then if your vegetables are brown or wilted or they kind of smell already starting to ferment or something, then you don't want to use it. But usually, even if they're not stored in water, even if they're just stored plain like that, they can go for a week or 10 days. And then once you have enough of a collection to boil in a pot, just boil it up for about 20 minutes. Don't turn it off and let them then just sit in the water until another hour, because then they can start to get acidic and they get kind of tart if you let them sit. It's just like with tea. If you let tea sit for too long, it gets like that acid taste, and we have found the vegetables will do the same thing. So after you turn it off, maybe let it cool for just about 10 minutes or 5 minutes and then just strain it right away and then save the water, or strain it immediately. But if you can't get to it immediately, you can let it sit for a few minutes, but not too long. Yes?
I'd like to see more pasta salads.
Okay, pasta salad, uh-huh, like macaroni salad? Sure,
with it. Maybe
with pasta, right.
Even. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
In there,
sure. Right. Yes. Day. Yes. Okay. That's maybe for like a Friday night buffet when we do that. Sure.
Something
okay.
Like that, or even stir-fried rice.
Really? Okay, I know, and it's funny because I've put that on the menu twice already, and the other cooks have had to change it because we haven't had enough of the vegetables. For some reason, the head cook, Dane, had to change it last Monday because the vegetables, some of them didn't come in or something. So I've had it on the menu actually twice since I've been doing menus, and it's gotten changed by the other cooks both times. But yeah, stir-fry, we definitely like to, I'll just note these, stir-fry and macaroni salads, more like pasta salads.